You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Thank you all, and out of respect for everyone who I'm sure is interested in hearing from panelists and asking questions of your own, I'm going to keep this fairly brief. For a lawyer, that's 15 minutes, 20 minutes. So I'll try and keep it down so that we can really get on to the most significant part of the evening. One of the things I'd point out, actually, that was just left out of the bio was when I was working, I worked for the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office for 15 years, and my last 5 years were as a public corruption prosecutor. And so I was responsible for investigating and prosecuting the judges, police officers, and public officials. So I was very popular. And I actually was responsible for uncovering what was then the largest police scandal in LAPD history. And I was allowed inside the Los Angeles Police Department Internal Affairs Division, the first person from the outside ever allowed inside. And what I saw was pretty horrific as far as their inability to police themselves. They were unfair to officers. They were unfair to community members. They were almost systemically corrupt without intentionally being so. And by the end of the scandal, which did not have a good ending because of political interference in the end, I really wanted to have an impact on policing, not just in deciding whether or not to prosecute somebody for a crime, but looking at tactics and training and policy and wanting to really have an impact and the ability to ensure effective and constitutional policing. When I came up with a list of suggestions on how the LAPD could better police itself, I went to my boss, the district attorney, and he looked at the list and he says, "We're not going to go there." And we were done. At that time, however, the United States was starting to create these professional police oversight organizations. And that's what led me to Portland, Oregon, to work as their police auditor. After about 4 years, the city and county of Denver created another police monitor program that what I used to say was it took the good, it got rid of the bad, and it prettied up the ugly of the Portland program. And so I went on over there. I was there for 7 years, and I felt that we accomplished a lot as far as reforms in the disciplinary process. And by the way, I'm saying process now, not process, so I'm becoming appropriately Canadianized. But basically, there was still lots of resistance from the police. There were lots of challenges still to go on in Portland, but I saw what was happening in B.C., and I saw that they were creating this program, which really doesn't exist in the United States, where a civilian-led program conducting criminal investigations of police uses of force. And it's really a remarkable thing. And even in Canada, Canada's the leader in the world in this area. We've got the Ontario SIU, we've got the Alberta ACER team, the Alberta Serious Incident Response Team, and now the British Columbia IO. And I'll explain in just a moment how the IO even differs and how it's moved ahead of the other provinces. But this is really a remarkable type of program. It's a remarkable opportunity, a remarkable experience. And one of the things I looked at when I was trying to decide whether to come here was, well, first of all, I had heard it was the best place on earth, so I, you know, that had to be part of the reason to come here. But, you know, what I was looking at was what is the level of resistance or level of support from the various stakeholders? Because in Denver, I had come across extreme conflict with the police unions, and they didn't buy into the program, and it made it very difficult to be successful. We accomplished a lot, but it was a very long and difficult road, and we weren't even done after 7 years. So what I was looking for was, is this program going to have the opportunity to succeed? So the first thing I look at is, where are the police chiefs? Where are the police executives? Do they support this program? And I saw that they did. Then I looked and I said, what about the police unions? Are they supportive? Are they against it? Are they rabidly against it? Are they generally lukewarm? And I saw that they came out in support of independent investigations of the police by this organization. And I looked at the civil liberties organizations, because if they're creating a program that the civil liberties organizations oppose, That's going to be problematic as well. And I saw that the civil liberties organizations were in favor of it. And then I looked at the primary next question is, what about the government? Is the government willing to adequately resource this kind of program? One of the problems in Ontario when they created the SIU 20 years ago was it was absolutely inadequately resourced. It couldn't do the job. And it took them about 15 years before they realized that they had to give it a budget. They had to make sure they had enough investigators and the tools to do the job. And I looked at it and I saw a budget of $10 million a year to start up and the ability to create investigative teams that could do the job right. Once I saw that all four of those stakeholders were supportive of this concept and that it was the best place on earth, that's when I decided to apply. And actually, it was 1 year ago, this last Friday, I first met with Minister Bond and spoke with her about the job and then was offered the job. And I'm coming up on the year anniversary of the announcement of my hiring. I will admit I am still in a honeymoon period. I do not expect it to last. Certainly the first controversial decision I make, I will be challenged. But what I plan to do is I've got three primary goals for the IO. The first goal is competent, fair, unbiased investigations. Obviously, we have to have that to make this thing work. If we're not doing it competently, nobody can trust the work that we do. If we're not doing it fairly in an unbiased manner, then we are legitimately subject to appropriate criticism, and it's absolutely unacceptable. The second goal is timeliness, and this is essential. It has taken anywhere from 1 to 2 years for investigations involving critical incidents, officer-involved shootings, in-custody deaths, for them to be completed to the point that even a decision is made whether it's going to go to Crown Counsel or not, or whether a prosecution is going to occur. It is absolutely unfair for the officers who are involved to not know whether they're going to be criminally charged an offense for 1 to 2 years. It is absolutely unfair to the affected persons and their families to not know what's going to happen for 1 to 2 years. It's unfair to all the stakeholders. It is simply unacceptable. And so we are going to have to change, put years into months and months into weeks. And that is a primary goal of the IO, to do these competently and timely. And I've told my people, you know what? It doesn't matter how competent you are if you're untimely. If it takes 1 to 2 years to finish these investigations, you will not have the public's faith. So competency and timeliness. And the third part, which is really essential, is the transparency part, the public reporting through, or transparency through public reporting. And this has actually been a great challenge just in the past couple of weeks as we've gotten cases coming in. On our first day, we had a fatal officer-involved shooting in Prince George that we had to roll out on. Since then, we've had now 4 officer-involved shootings and 2 in-custody deaths, and we've been open for 8 weeks. These are all significant investigations that take an enormous amount of resources. We have dispatched anywhere from 8 to 10 investigators to each incident. We had one evening where we had 2 fatal incidents in one night. 17 of our 28 investigators had to be dispatched on that to each incident. And so they take an enormous amount of resources. They're very labor intensive, but obviously we've got to get it done. Now the problem though is that the public then questions when it first occurs. The media comes to me and says, what happened? There's an incident that occurred in Vancouver today. What happened? And I can't tell them what happened. Why? Well, I don't know. And I won't know until we've investigated it. They want to hear, did the suspect fire shots at the police? Did the suspect threaten the police with a weapon? What was the weapon that the suspect had? What weapon did the police use? What was the cause of death? These are all questions, and they're absolutely legitimate questions that everyone wants to know. You want to know if an incident happened with your local police, is there a problem with it? Is there reason to have faith in your police, or is there reason to believe that the police acted inappropriately and need to be held accountable? But the reality is, and I've been holding a tight rope with the media thus far, is I will not state what happened without knowing what happened. I should not go in front of television cameras and to reporters and tell them this is what happened when I won't know what happened until the investigation is thorough and complete, until the investigation is complete. Now, what I now have to do, if I'm not talking within the day or two after the incident, is guess what? We're going to have to do this investigation in a timely fashion, and I've got to be able to convince everybody that there will be robust public reporting on what happened at the conclusion, and you're not going to have to wait 1 to 2 years to find out. So that's really the context that we're sitting in today. Now, the other thing that I need to point out, because this is something that a lot of people do not understand, is what is our mandate? What is it that we actually investigate? And so basically what the IO does is we investigate on and off-duty incidents involving police that result in either death or serious harm. So, and I can go on for quite a while on the challenges, in fact, in determining whether a death is really a police-related death or not. And believe it or not, you know, I've had hours and hours of discussions with my people trying to identify, is a suicide that took place 6 or 8 hours after somebody was released from custody, is that a police-related death? If the police officer drives up to somebody on a bridge and that person jumps from the bridge, is that a police-related death? And I'll tell you what we've come to the conclusion of is, first, when you have a suicidal person and a death, there needs to be an action and a reaction for it to be police-related. So if a police officer merely drives up and the person looks at the police officer and then jumps, we're not considering that a police-related death. Even if a police officer engages somebody but says, please, don't jump, you have everything to live for, and the person jumps, not a police-related death. But if there's an action and reaction, the police breach a home or, you know, break into a door and then the person kills himself, that would obviously be police-related. But there are significant challenges in really trying to figure out what's within our mandate and what's not. Now, the other part that's very interesting is serious harm. And the definition of serious harm is an injury that may result in death. So that's a life-threatening injury, and I think most of us could probably get our hands around that. Or may cause serious disfigurement. And part of the question is, all right, what is disfigurement, and then what's serious disfigurement? So what we've come up with is basically a broken nose may be disfigurement, but it's generally not serious disfigurement. So it needs to be something higher than that. What the legislature was saying was, we want the IO investigating serious, very serious injuries and deaths. We do not necessarily want the IO investigating at this time less severe injuries, because frankly at that point we wouldn't be adequately resourced to investigate all of the incidents. Then there's also may cause substantial loss or impairment of mobility of the body as a whole or the function of any limb or organ, and that's a mouthful. And again, difficult to determine. So a broken arm may not fall within that definition, but if it's a broken arm that's not going to heal, or if there's substantial medical intervention that's required, then that would be the type of case we'd investigate. So the IO in general, and let me also point out that the off-duty aspect, so if a police officer off-duty were to drive impaired, crash and kill or seriously injure somebody, that would be our case. If a police officer were to engage in active domestic violence resulting in death or serious harm, that's our case. Off-duty, a fight, that's our case. If an officer is on vacation up north, rolls his or her car and kills or injures somebody, that's our case. These off-duty incidents, interestingly enough, no other province has got an independent investigations office or an independent agency conducting those investigations. So that's a place where BC is out in front of every other province. Now, as the CCD, the Chief Civilian Director, I am not permitted to have ever served as a police officer. I'm appointed to a 5-year term, and then I have the possibility of being reappointed to another 5-year term. So for 10 years in total, I'm going to have to stay in BC because my mortgage is 30 years, so I got to figure out 20 years more, I'll have to figure out what to do. Maybe I'll teach at SFU. Our office, myself and my investigators, have all the powers, duties, and immunities of constables of common law and jurisdiction throughout the province. So my people have all the powers of a peace officer to conduct their investigations. Did I give them badges? No. They don't need no stinking badges, okay? They've got credentials. Did I give them guns? No. You know, I don't want to try and figure out who's going to investigate an IO involved shooting. You know, and they don't need that. But what we are is, right now we've got 28 investigators. 50% of them have extensive police investigatory experience. So these are individuals who have retired from policing. They have to be 5 years removed from policing in BC, but they were the group that I could bring on to try and ensure that on day one we were capable of investigating even the most serious incident, including an off-duty homicide. 50% of my people are civilians. They've never worked as police officers. They've gotten their investigative experience from areas within from civilian areas, professional areas, which includes journalism, ICBC, WorkSafe, the coroner service. That got fairly reported that we took quite a few former coroners. So we've got a nice balance between former police and people who have not been police, and we're trying to create a culture that is different than the police culture, that ensures that there's going to be accountability, unbiased investigations overall, and obviously I'll be reporting to you on how well we've accomplished those goals in the next year to come. Our office is located in Surrey. I decided that I did not want to create at this time satellite offices in the north or on the island. This is going to impact our ability to timely respond to incidents because we're coming from Surrey, so if it's in the north, the southeast, the island, it's going to take us some time to get there. But I wanted to make sure that everyone was in one place, that I would be able to ensure that I could create a culture of accountability, that the former police understand what the expectations are, that the civilians understand the expectations, and that we create a culture within the IO that will work as far as our mission, vision, and goals. Let me take a step back because this is very important. So how do we find out about an incident? How does this work? And what happens is that we are notified by, or the police agencies are required to notify the IO immediately upon an incident occurring. So basically, now immediate does not mean that an officer fires shots and then, calls for backup and then calls the IO. But what it means is that the duty officers who learn about the shooting, learn about the incident very quickly after it occurs, they're monitoring their officer's actions. That person is calling the IO, letting us know an incident has occurred, and then briefing us on an ongoing basis as we then respond to the team. Until we arrive at the incident, the police departments are required by statute, by the Police Act, to take any lawful measures necessary to obtain and preserve evidence. So what that means is, and I've said this to the police quite a lot, is so if there's an impaired driving collision, and you've got an off-duty officer there, you better not be standing there saying, oh, I better wait for the IO to get here before we take this officer in for testing. That evidence is temporal, and it can deteriorate, and we expect that that officer will then be immediately taken to the nearest facility to have the testing done so we know what their blood alcohol level was. If a storm is blowing in, we expect them to start processing the scene. See, I said processing again. I'm very proud of that. I learned recently that Canada won the War of 1812. I didn't know that. And I was a U.S. history major, too. But basically, we arrive at the scene as soon as we can. But the reality is that if the evidence is deteriorating, the police have to maintain that status quo. If there's a witness there who wants to leave and they have no right to detain that witness, and that witness does not have an address and cannot otherwise be located, if there's a problem that whether they can be located, they're going to have to take a statement from that witness. If there are witnesses there who want to leave but who have addresses and phone numbers that we can contact them, they're going to need to take down that information because they've got to help us ensure that we can have a competent investigation. They can't just let evidence go away or let witnesses go away. And I got to say thus far, the departments understand that and they've been acting accordingly and we've had no issues or concerns with respect to their making sure that they're taking lawful means to preserve the evidence that's necessary. And then upon our arrival, they must relinquish the control over the investigation of the incident to our office, and again, they have done that within the last 2 months. We reached very early on a memorandum of understanding with the police chiefs. We spent a lot of time going over my expectations of the police expectations and needs of the IO, and I think as a result of working on that MOU, we were able to come up with an agreement that seems to be working. It's a public document. It's published on our website. I'm going to call out, BC Civil Liberties and PIVOT both assisted in the development of the MOU as we were developing it with the, they didn't sign off on it, so they don't necessarily agree with everything, but as we were working with the police agencies to figure out what the memorandum of understanding would encompass, we did seek input from PIVOT and the BC Civil Liberties Association, and I think took quite a fair amount of that to the table, back to the table. There are also statutory requirements applicable to police witnesses, and this is a place where things are changing, I think, dramatically. First, under the Police Act, we designate, the IO designates whether an officer is a witness or a subject officer. And that actually becomes a very important distinction. If they're a witness officer, they are not, we're saying that they are not potentially subject to criminal liability. If they're a subject officer, they have potential jeopardy. Once we've designated them as a witness, they are required to cooperate with our investigators. They must make a statement to our investigators, and they must make a statement to our investigators at the time and place of our choosing. Now, there's been great debates in the police community over how long you should wait before taking a statement from the police. My answer is we need to take the statement from the police as soon as we possibly can. And so in the MOU, we specifically state that I expect that statements will be taken either before the end of the shift or within 24 hours afterwards. If it's not taken within that period of time, I expect there to be objective reasons why. So if it's not going to be within 24 hours of that incident, I want to know why, and there better be a good reason for it. Otherwise, they're going to be interviewed within that period. Under these circumstances, we can, in essence, compel the witness officers to cooperate, and under that circumstance, we cannot use the statement that they made against them in court because it's considered a compelled statement. My job as the CCD, I'm going to take a step away from investigations and say that there's another part of the job that's obviously essential. So the first part is making sure we've got investigations of integrity, making sure they're done timely, and then publicly reporting out on them. But I have a responsibility as a gatekeeper under the Police Act, under the IO portion of the Police Act. And my job is to determine whether or not, once the investigation is complete, I have to determine whether or not the officer may have committed a criminal act. If I believe an officer may have committed a criminal act, I'm required to send the case to Crown Counsel. Crown Counsel maintains their independence, and they decide in the end whether or not the officer will be charged. That's not my decision. My decision is whether to refer it to Crown. If I do not believe that an officer may have committed a criminal act, then it is my job to close the case without a referral to Crown. And under that circumstance, that's when the public can expect a robust report explaining why. The reality is that I may have made my name in prosecution of police officers and public officials, but the reality is the first time that I do not send a case to Crown in a controversial incident, if I don't explain why, people will be legitimately upset, angry, or outraged. The public has a right to have enough information that each individual person can reach their own determination as to whether my decision was appropriate or not. And so these decisions are going to have to be robust in the sense that they're not conclusory, that they lay out the information that I had placed before me that resulted in me making this ultimate decision. Let me finish up. With the question of the mandate and kind of going back to the mandate, and I'll tell you that one of the questions that I'm often asked is, well, sexual assault serious harm? And my answer is that ethically and morally, yes. Legally, no, unless it results in death or this serious type of bodily injury that I described previously. So currently, we do not have the mandate or jurisdiction to investigate allegations of sexual assault against police officers unless they have resulted in, the incident has resulted in death or serious harm. Now, what the government has done, is they've, or the legislature has done, is they created a statute where, by regulation, our mandate can be increased if and when appropriate. I have said from the very beginning we have to walk before we run. So I actually am very, I'm pleased that we weren't given a mandate that included every possible allegation of a crime against a police officer, because frankly, we'd be set up for failure. We need the opportunity to succeed. We need the opportunity to walk before we run. We need the opportunity to prove we can do these cases first. At that point, if we're showing competency, if we're being timely, then at that point, the government will have the opportunity to amend or enact regulations that can increase our mandate. And they can pick and choose specific statutes, statutory violations that we should be investigating. They can pick or choose to what extent our mandate will be increased. And so I obviously look forward to the time when I can prove that we're doing this job adequately and correctly, and that there's an opportunity to increase our mandate to do more and to do what the public needs and expects us to do. For now, we've got some very serious cases we're handling. This is definitely trial by fire. You know, I've said repeatedly, our resources have been are now completely resourced. And one of the things I said to people at the beginning, and was interesting, was I said on day one, we had to be ready for anything, including a fatal officer-involved shooting in Prince George. And I said this well before we started out on September 10th. We announced our opening, and 8 hours later, there was a fatal officer-involved shooting in Prince George. So I think we were able to roll out to that fairly effectively. You all will have an opportunity to see the quality of the investigation and its conclusion. And now what I've told my investigators is we've shown we're able to roll out, we've shown we're able to get this information quickly and, you know, and get back to the office to do the follow-up investigation. Now show me that we can complete these investigations in a timely fashion so that I can write these reports, publicly report the community, or send the cases to Crown that need to be sent. So with that, I'll turn it over to our facilitator to continue with the rest of the evening. Thank you.